We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 154. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today we interview Dr. Jesse Toon, and we'll talk to him about the drones he's using at his university and what they're using them for, and how he's teaching his students how to use drones responsibly in the field. Let's get to it. Welcome to the show, everybody. Paul, how's it going?
Oh, I think I'm doing okay. We are recording right now at the end of the first week in May, and this week we had all students back, well, almost all the students back on campus. So I haven't had a whole lot of downtime because we've had, you know, any of a myriad of different kind of technical glitches, network stuff. We've just been chasing our tails trying to get everything worked out and smoothed out so people can work. I think we're out of the woods, but it's been a bit of a slog. I think we'll be okay, though. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm not doing too bad. We are nearing the end of our time up here in Massachusetts, and we are on Saturday getting ready. Now, I've driven across the country a number of times as a CRM archaeologist, and usually I've done it overnight and in like one 28-hour, you know, slog where you're just going from like Florida to Montana or something. That's pretty common for CRM archaeologists. However, we're in a 26,000-pound house on wheels, and I work full-time, multiple jobs, and so that's not going to happen. So we're starting a 3,000-plus-mile drive back to Nevada on Saturday. We're taking the weekends to have longer drive days, and then during the week, we're basically moving every day, but only 2 to 3 hours a day around my work schedule. So that's going to be 2 weeks long. It's going to take us to get back to Nevada. Wow. It should be interesting.
Do you share driving duties or is it all you?
My God, do I wish I could share driving duties, but it is all me. So that being said, when I want like a coffee or something, I can crank up the generator and she can kick me out an espresso while we're going down the interstate. That's pretty sweet. All right. Speaking of technology, we're going to bring on our guest today, Dr. Jesse Toon. Jesse, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. Thanks for having me on. We're just now finishing up the end of the semester here at Fort Lewis College. I actually hit submit on my final grades about 30 minutes ago. Oh, so the spring 2021 semester is officially over. Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, congratulations on that. So let's talk about why we brought you on today. First, I want to say some of our more savvy listeners across the Archaeology Podcast Network might recognize you from your appearance on the Life in Ruins podcast. I think it's going to be probably a few weeks to a month ago at this point as we're talking in real time. So if you're interested in hearing a little bit more about Jesse's career and some of the stuff that they talk about on that show, we'll link to that in the show notes so you can go find that other episode that he was on.
Jesse, I actually did listen to that episode because I listened to a lot of APN episodes. And I've got to say, I'm just going to jump out with this. I've got some beef with you.
Fair
enough. Joke about going from aerospace to anthro to archaeology and going just slowly through the course catalog, I've been using that same joke for over 20 years now because I went aerospace to anthro to archaeology, and in archaeology my focus was architecture. So I've just been very, very slowly working through that same course catalog, and I'm so envious that you got to make the joke on air first before I ever did.
That is too funny. Oh my goodness.
Nice.
But that's why we have you on today. That first step of the process, the aerospace, because as listeners to this podcast know, Chris and I are both aerospace geeks, as are you, I guess.
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
So let's start off talking about that. We're talking about drones today, as we mentioned in the introduction. How long, I mean, you're a professor. How long ago did you start bringing drones into the curriculum or into your research? How did that start?
That's a good question. So it's really kind of developed as a side research endeavor, I guess you could say, because my primary research interests are stone tools and environmental change and human migrations, but landscape level questions more broadly. And so all of my training was really kind of in much more traditional archaeology. And it wasn't until I got here to Fort Lewis about 6 years ago that I had the opportunity to kind of start investing in a drone fleet and building that out some. So It's really only been 4 or 5 years since I've really been using drones quite frequently in some of my research.
I should give a public service announcement right now for all of you out there that are longtime listeners of the Archaeotech podcast. There's a drinking game that listeners have suggested that every time we say the word drone on this podcast, that you take a drink. But I'm going to say right now, maybe just put the alcohol away today, because we don't want to be responsible for any illnesses as a result of listening to this show.
It's not a good show to try that drinking game. I don't think.
It's really not. It's really not. Nice.
I do. Yes. So, You know, I went through flight school and everything. And so I have the private license, and then.
Oh, you're full private as well.
Yeah. Right. Nice. And a few kind of secondary certificates that came along with that I picked up through flight school. And then, just kind of transitioned that into the whole drone cert.
Nice. Yeah. I've been thinking about drones for a long time because I'm also a pilot. I actually kind of went through the same course catalog, except I went the other direction because mine was basically aviation, not necessarily aerospace, because I went through basically a commercial, like collegiate level aviation program, which was how I got my private and my instrument and commercial training, and then kind of backslided to anthropology and then and archaeology.
Yeah, that's funny.
I was already at the other end of the alphabet. I was going the other direction. So, you know, what can I do? So
zoology didn't do it for you, huh?
No, really didn't. Couldn't come back around. So now that you're here, you mentioned drone fleet. I'm interested in that because a lot of people, you know, come on and say, oh, we bought a drone. We've got one or two. Let's set the stage here. What does your current drone fleet consist of? What's your equipment?
So the first drone that I picked up, and really the one that I still use most frequently, is just one of the good old DJI Phantom 3s, Phantom Pro 3. Mm-hmm. And man, that thing is a workhorse. I don't know how many times I've crashed it
tanks.
Picks up and keeps on going. So that's kind of been for a few years my primary platform. And then I also had, emphasis on had, past tense, disco that one of the fixed wing discos. And you know, those things really come apart in a lot of pieces when you slam them into the side of a mountain.
Who would have thought?
So fortunately I was able to salvage some of the pieces off of that, and I also have a Matrix 100 that I'm really kind of starting to transition over to for some of the longer missions and things like that the fixed wing used to facilitate.
I'm very interested in your thoughts on, you know, uses between, and I'm glad you're mentioning fixed wing as well, because when people think of drones these days, they think of obviously quadcopters and the utility of quadcopters, but we've had fixed wing remote control aircraft forever. I mean, my grandfather, you know, used to build designs out of Popular Mechanics and RC Modeler magazine for fixed wing aircraft. Then my dad got into it. I mean, that was 40, 50 years ago. So we've had those kinds of things for a long time. But talk to us about how you use, like what kind of use cases you would choose a fixed wing over, say, a quadcopter type model, and, you know, how you'd use those differently.
Sure. So, you know, kind of like you said, most people today just immediately go to, you know, some of the quadcopter DJI products, which are fantastic. But for some of the research projects that I do, you know, you're really limited by battery life. You're limited by weight capacity, you know, the types of sensors that you can put on there. And so that was really the primary reason that I wanted that Parrot Disco to begin with, because it is fixed wing. It had a much longer battery life. And the version that I picked up came with the multispectral sensor, as well as just kind of the RGB sensor on it. And so it just really kind of opened the door for a lot of additional level research projects. You know, for example, I used that particular drone when we were mapping the Blackwater Draw Clovis site, the type site for Clovis projectile points in New Mexico. And, you know, there's no way I could have done that amount of survey with, say, the DJI Phantom or something like that, just because of battery life. So, yeah, you know, those fixed wing platforms like you're talking about. They've been around for a long time. It, you know, you could almost argue that they've been really perfected. I know the power source has changed quite a bit over the years, but it was really great having that extended flight time with the fixed wings.
When you're saying extended flight time and battery life, what are you talking about here with the Disco? How long can you keep it up in the air?
The Parrot Disco, on average, I was probably running 35 to 40 minutes per battery.
It's not bad.
No.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, doubling or a little bit more what you could get out of the DJI Phantom. And also it is moving a lot faster as well, right? So you got the longer battery life and flight time, and it's moving a little faster. And so you're just able to cover a lot larger area if you're trying to survey, you know, really big landscape level areas.
When you're doing that, are you just running in like an ultra high speed, you know, micro or regular SD card to process photos you're just taking them? Or are you just higher up and taking wider photos basically? So basically fewer of them, maybe the same amount at the same rate, but since you're going so much faster, you still need that overlap when you're doing, you know, photogrammetry type stuff, right? So what's your methodology on that?
You know, I try to really be as versatile as possible because every single site that I'm working on is very different because of all kinds of factors. And, you know, like you hit at just then, right? You're constantly dealing with these trade-offs with altitude and an area that you're surveying versus resolution and what you're actually capturing there. So, you know, it really just kind of depends on exactly what I'm trying to do, to be honest.
Sure. Now, with the Parrot Disco, I've never flown one of those. The only thing I've flown that was fixed wing other than real airplanes was, you know, some of the old model airplanes, like I said, that my dad used to have. And those were usually like a gas engine, you know, 6 or 8 channel radio. I mean, it could be 4 channel, but if you've got like flaps or landing gear or something like that, yeah, you add a few more channels to that. But are you flying the Parrot Disco, or is it launching and flying a predetermined flight path? Or did you have to learn how to fly fixed wing? Because, you know, I'll tell you what, you know, Paul and I have had a lot of conversations about learning how to fly drones back when he was doing that a number of episodes ago. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, buy a cheap one from the gas station or Walmart because you're going to break it. But even those, when you just let go, most of the time they just hover. You know what I mean? But if you let go of the controls on a fixed wing, it's just going to fly straight into a mountain. So did you have to learn how to fly that, or do these fly a predetermined flight path, or a combination of the two?
A combination of the two. Yeah. You know, a lot of what I do for my research, it is very regimented. You know, I need to make sure that I'm recording images at a very regular interval. And many times it's requiring me to go back and fly this exact same flight path multiple times.
Sure.
And so typically, you know, I just program everything into PIX4D and run the whole, you know, flight off of the tablet there. However, there definitely is some more manual components to flying the Parrot Disco, having to kind of override it at times to, you know, make sure that nothing is interfering with the landing, because, you know, it really is a fixed wing aircraft. You have to have a landing path, that glide path coming in, and the same thing for taking off as well. And so those are all kinds of things that may change from time to time after you launch it and by the time it's ready to come back down. And so, yeah, it really is kind of a combination of hand flying that and using kind of an automated flight plan.
Is the Parrot a hand launched aircraft, or does it have a landing gear?
It is hand launched. Yeah. So
you basically toss it.
Exactly right. There's some fantastic pictures of me floating around out there somewhere of very, you know, daintily throwing the thing up into the air. And, you know, then when it comes back down, it basically just is designed glide to in. Kind of crash, glide into the ground. Yeah.
Yeah. You basically stop the prop, or I think some of those even have a prop that kind of folds back to prevent it from getting damaged. I don't know what the Parrot Disco has. Yeah.
Yeah. It has one of those kind of folding retractable pusher props in the back. Yeah.
I know it's a little bit early, but why don't we go ahead and take a break, and we'll have a little bit longer segment next time, because I want to talk about some of the actual projects you've used this on and how the data from these flight methods have augmented the other data that you've collected and what it's helped you learn about the research questions you're trying to answer. So let's do that. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back on the other side. In the meantime, if you want to support the Archaeology Podcast Network, go to archpodnet.com/members and join us today. We've had some really great questions and discussions on our members only Slack team, which is kind of a messaging service kind of thing, an app you can use on your phone or tablet or whatever, or log into from the internet and talk to our hosts and talk to other members behind the scenes. All right. So with that, we'll be back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code Archaeotech. That's ARCHAEOTECH. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello, welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode number 154. Today we're talking to Dr. Jesse Toon about his use of drones in his research and his teaching. And as listeners to our show know, I work in an edtech environment, and so I'm always interested in how people teach their students and why and what they're doing. And so you, as I understand, Jesse, are using drones with your students. You're teaching them how to use them. You're teaching them presumably how to build research designs around them or with them. And I'd like to hear from you exactly what it is that you're doing, what their responses to these have been.
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, it's like I said earlier, the drone component of my research really developed as a side project almost, and has really ended up being very pervasive in nearly everything that I do now. And, you know, my primary job is professor of archaeology here at Fort Lewis. And so I'm constantly working with students in the classroom and then outside as well, as frequently as we can get outside doing some field work and drone work as well. Mm-hmm. In the past, I occasionally teach a class for drones and research. It's gone by a couple of different names, but yeah, it's typically drones for archaeological research.
Cool. How can I sign up?
I know, right? Yeah, it's actually opened up beyond just my archaeology students. And I typically have students from all across campus that are taking that course. Everything from more of the environmental management, environmental science departments, as well as some of the geoscience and GIS certificate students, because we have a GIS certificate program here as well. And that's really been quite fun for me, being able to engage with students all across campus around this, you know, kind of common method of collecting data and doing research. So, you know, normally the way that I kind of approach teaching in on the classroom side of things, you know, we'll start out by just kind of having some really good conversations about being frank. Why is everyone here, right? You know, we're coming from many different departments across campus. So why are you here? What do you want to get out of this? You know, and we really spend a little while diving into all of the different applications of drone platforms. You know, one of the things that I frequently talk to my students about is that this is still relatively new, and it's progressed very quickly. And so we're still many times just trying to figure out exactly what we can use drones for. You know, it's almost like, hate to be cliche here, but the sky's the limit, you know, almost on on the applications for how we can use drones in research. And then, you know, from there, we typically kind of walk through all of the FAA requirements, the kind of the first third to half of a semester we really spend in the classroom prepping students for the FAA exams. We can't offer them here on campus, but my goal is to basically say, you know, you finish my class and you're prepared to go to a testing facility and, you know, pass the exam with no problems. And then the last half of the semester, we're going out, we're actually flying the quadcopters, the fixed wings, collecting data, and then doing kind of some initial processing with programs like PIX4D and throwing some of those data sets into ArcGIS to play around with them and show the students really, you know, what we can do and why we're doing this. You know, it's not just a hobby. It's not just we're flying drones for fun. It, as the class title implies, you know, it's drones for research. There's a reason for this.
Right. That reason is interesting to me, just in a broader sense, because the three of us have a pre-existing interest in aviation. Well, maybe it was later for you, Chris, but every time I wanted to bring in aviation, you know, drones, as I've mentioned before, you know, kites and balloons and whatever, it always felt kind of like this would be kind of cool if, and now I feel like we've hit a tipping point where it's not a cool experiment to see if I can get a different kind of data. It's worked. It's more integrated into a lot of different archaeological research. I'm sure other, you know, physical and natural sciences as well. And so I don't even have a question here about this. It's just, it's interesting to me that maybe in the last 10 years, definitely in the last 10 years, but maybe within the last 5 years, we've gone from being, you know, using drones for archaeology is kind of at the outer edge of a cool thing you might be able to do that, hey, this is a neat thing to, yeah, of course we use drones. This is part of our work. Why don't you?
Right. Yeah. How do you do archaeology without a drone? I don't get it. Yeah.
I'm in CRM archaeology, of course, and I'm looking forward to seeing a job posting that says, hey, we're looking for somebody who can, you know, handle extreme weather environments, carry 50 pounds, walk through the desert 10 hours a day, and has a Part 107 license, which I think I forgot to mention. Paul pointed out that I said Part 106 earlier. I just had like Section 106 of the NHPA on my head probably. And, you know, 106, 107, it's all the same.
You just did the opposite that I did last recording.
Right.
Yeah, exactly, all of those numbers and acronyms, they really bleed together. You know, we talk about CRM as archaeologists, but half the time my mind reverts back to crew resource management from my aerospace days going through you know, college classes.
Yeah, it's not customer relations management.
Right. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm in another business too, where I'm doing like software implementation and they talk about CRM there too. And exactly what Paul just said, customer relations management or customer, even sometimes customer resource management when you're dealing with like sales cycles and stuff. But then, yeah, crew resource management, cockpit resource management, I've heard it called, and just all kinds of stuff. Most people, you tell their year in CRM, they just kind of look at you funny because like, how can you be in that? What does that even mean? So... yeah, that's really interesting. I'm interested to hear, I'm encouraged to hear, I should say, that you're basically in your class. I mean, people are coming out of that with the ability to theoretically pass the FAA exam for the Part 107 license. That's pretty awesome. I've heard of other people bringing drones and things like that into a technology and stuff like that class, but I think this is the first one I've heard about that specifically really does give you some actionable training that you can use for something. And it's not just like theoretical, here's what we can do. It's you can now actually go do something. That's pretty awesome. I like that. Has the reception to that been pretty good? Do you have people talking about that? Are they using it? Because you mentioned people coming in from kind of all over campus to take this class, not just like archaeologists. So, I mean, is there good feedback on that? Is the class always full or how do you think it's doing?
Yeah. You know, every time that I've taught the class, it's pretty much filled immediately. And,
nice.
You know, everyone, all of the students are very energetic and excited about it, you know, and largely, I think, because of what you just brought up. It's this idea that it's very applied and there's, you know, some objectionable goals there at the end where, you know, they can go out, get their license and do this themselves, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I try to really incorporate that kind of that mentality, those goals into my classes. And I think maybe some of that comes from, you know, my days in aerospace before I got into archaeology, kind of thinking about, you know, going through and taking all of those FAA exams and the training and the studying and the preparation that it requires, you know. And so for me transitioning to the drone license, I don't want to sound pretentious, but it was fairly easy because I'd already taken much more complex FAA exams. Right. And yeah, many of my friends and colleagues and the students that, you know, I'm working with, they don't have that background. And so if I can build the class around that to make sure they're getting the support and training that they need to immediately go and pass one of the drone exams, then, you know, it makes me happy and excited about what I'm doing, basically.
So keeping on the teaching theme real quick, I'm interested in how the archaeologists are receiving this data, right? Like the, because, I mean, in the past, archaeologists have been, I don't want to say Luddites, but somewhat notoriously tech averse, you know what I mean? And how are the, for lack of a better way to say it, kids, I'll just say students, how are the new students coming in today? Because they could be of any age. I went to college when I was 30, so there you go. How are they accepting having to learn this skill as a possible thing that, listen, this is something you just have to add to your skill set? It's not going to be all, you know, whips and hats. It's you need to learn some actual technology here, including like how to operate a Trimble and a total station and, you know, all those other things. Now you have to learn how to fly. How is that being received by the archaeology students?
You know, from what I've seen, from my experience, most of them are really excited about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting kind of what you said there. I start the archaeological field school in about 9 or 10 days now. And that's what I've been meeting with the students that are going to be taking that summer course with me. We've been meeting and talking about this, that it is very much tech oriented. You know, it's not just going out, walking some transects, digging a shovel test. We're still doing that, but sure. I want to make sure that my students get the training that they need to basically leave here and be qualified for any kind of field tech job that comes up, you know, whether it's just kind of good old fashioned survey and shovel testing, or if it is something a little bit more advanced, right? Where having some background and training in total stations using Trimbles and flying drones, you know, if that's going to better prepare them for where I think archaeology is heading in the future, then, you know, that's my goal there.
No, I like that. I've been seeing this as a trend amongst a number of people we've had as guests on this network that are training the next generation of archaeologists and trying to bring in a more holistic approach to how they do their research, but also so that they can make a living doing their work, because as we all know, very few people are getting rich doing archaeology.
Right.
But I'm very curious about the training that you're doing with the students, the class, and you're having them fly, and then you're bringing in the data that they've collected and then processing them, you know, again, on the computers. Does that interest in the aviation part that they obviously are coming to your class with, does that translate into interest in the post-processing as well?
You know, it does. Not necessarily for every single person, of course. You know, some of my students are much more interested in just purely the archaeology or just the collection of, you know, aerial data. But many of them are really kind of interested in kind of this whole process of collecting, processing, and presenting that data. And I think some of that comes probably from the strength of our GIS certificate here, because that certificate program is housed in geoscience, where I have a lot of good friends and colleagues. And so we do a lot of kind of interdisciplinary cross-departmental training and are constantly, you know, sharing students back and forth between classes, where there our students are really kind of getting a big picture understanding of why we're doing this. Again, for me, many times it comes back to the justification for why we're doing this. You know, you don't have to go to college, pay tuition and take classes to learn how to fly a drone. You know, you can do that on your own. So right. If you're going to be here doing this with me, then we're going to talk about why and what those applications of the data really are.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. All right. So let's, like you said, we're not just learning how to fly drones here. We're learning why we need to fly drones. So let's talk about this in the context of a project where you used fixed wing or, you know, rotor wing aircraft to maybe answer a primary research question or even enhance or augment. Like, you know, most of the times we use many tools to answer a research question or a suite of research questions on a project. So let's have an example of a project that you used one of these methods on, and then we'll dig into it from there.
Sure. So kind of like you were saying, we're oftentimes using many different methods of data collection to kind of help one another to augment one data set to another and kind of build that out a little bit more. So like I mentioned at the very beginning of all this, a lot of my interests lie within these broader kind of landscape level questions, right? And so for instance, just, about a week and a half ago, I was out helping some public land managers survey and document an archaeological site. And one of the big reasons that I was involved, there were two technically. One, it was a late Pleistocene site, which is really kind of my analytical specialty, kind of Ice Age period stone tools. But the other reason why I was there on that project was to collect some of the data to help construct site maps and create topographic maps and digital elevation models of the landscape. And, you know, we could have gone out there with a small crew, with a total station and a couple of stadia rods, and spent 2 days shooting in a few points and putting together a fairly decent topo map, a site-specific kind of micro topo map. Or I was able to fly a drone for about an hour and collect data across the entire landform. So we were able to really get an excellent view of kind of what the alluvial geomorphology, kind of these stream cuts and terrace sequences looked like, as well as the surrounding uplands. And that's really helping us think about not just where the archaeology is, but more importantly to me, why? Why is the archaeology there? What was it about this particular place on the landscape that was really drawing people to it for thousands of years in this case? And that was a question that all of us, when we were standing around surveying the site, we kept asking, well, why were people here? This particular place of all places on this landscape? And it wasn't really until I got back into the lab and I was able to process some of that data to get a much better perspective of what those landforms looked like and kind of think about how the stream was flowing through time and kind of this one somewhat protected area near a cliff line, between a cliff line and kind of this small hill. So, you know, it gives us a lot of insight into how people were using the landscape in the past.
Nice. Wow. That's really cool. I like that. Yeah.
The why people do things in a place is such an important question always. The more we can bring to bear, the more different kinds of analyses we can do, the more different kinds of questions we can ask around that, you know, whether they're theoretical or like what you're saying, data collection, so that we can then get, you know, in your case, you know, kind of a God's eye view of the landscape and then turn that back around and, you know, ask new questions. Yeah, it's just valuable, you know, and it's one of the cooler things I think about archaeology is we've basically gone landscape archaeologists, everybody everywhere in the last 40 years or so, as opposed to, you know, this purely site-based archaeology that used to be. I think that's a fantastic question. I love to hear when people ask that and apply it directly in their own research. So thanks.
Yeah, you know, and kind of thinking about that maybe a little bit more and referring back to some of the CRM type of research that we were talking about earlier, it's also kind of an efficiency aspect to all of this as well. You know,
absolutely.
Like I was mentioning, you know, it'd take a crew a couple of days to collect the amount of data that I collected in an hour. Right. And I'm not advocating for the robots taking over our jobs, right? I'm not going down that road, but it's just a more effective use of our time. And so that way, you know, we as archaeologists can spend maybe more time looking at the artifacts, analyzing them, thinking about these questions about why were people there, instead of just walking around holding a stadia pole and someone talking into a walkie-talkie saying, okay, got it, go on to the next one.
That is a great place to stop, because if I don't, I could literally respond to that for probably the next hour, because I have been beating that drum for a long time. So let's take a break and come back and continue this discussion with Dr. Jesse Toon on the other side. Back in a minute.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 154, and this is our final segment with Dr. Jesse Toon talking about drones. Take a drink. That's your only one. There you go.
One for just one.
So at the end of the last segment, you mentioned using drones, like you did the work of, you know, what would have taken people days to do. You did that work in an hour with a fixed wing drone. I did this project that we've talked about a few times on a military installation down in Southern California, 30,000 acres, unexploded ordnance, rattlesnakes that aren't afraid of anybody, lots of really bad things on that project, right? And when you're talking about 30,000 acres of survey that took us 8 months to do, two crews of four, eight people, took us 8 months to do, the amount of acreage that actually encompassed sites was only about 1,500. And we had some pretty big sites. So about 1,500 of those were acres of sites. And then the other, you know, 28,500 acres were just stuff we had to survey over to find the sites, right? And it just got me thinking, it's a wide open landscape. There's there's little vegetation, no trees, almost no topography in most of it because of where they had us surveying. We weren't up in the hills. We were down in the flatlands, playa in some cases, but just literally flat in other cases. And I'm like, man, if we had photogrammetric drone survey out here that was 100% coverage with maybe even some AI to do pattern recognition to at least do some initial site identification, I could imagine we could have done the project in a couple months with a few people rather than 8 months with eight people and risking injury, death, even. I mean, just putting it right out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a number of snake incidents that were pretty close to bites. Oof. That people had, and a number of incidents where we got pretty close to what we thought was unexploded ordnance that our EOD technicians had to call in when we saw them. So is it worth it? You know what I mean? Like, people say we don't want robots doing our job for us, but where do you think you land on where we're at technologically to be able to do pattern recognition or not even pattern recognition, but even having somebody go through the footage after it was collected and stitched together and you've got these 3D models of the whole landscape. If you've got, you know, centimeter or less resolution, so you can identify, you know, potential archaeology sites and then just have archaeologists go out and field test the hits that you find on that. Where do you think we're at in getting to that level right now? Do you think we're close? Because I don't know if we have that kind of resolution right now.
You know, I think it's one of those cases where maybe sometimes we do want robots doing our job because of, you know, the snakes and the unexploded ordnance issue. Right. Right. But, you know, that's actually something that I'm working on. Kind of that broader question is something that I'm working on right now, doing some experiments with a couple of my students, looking at elevation, resolution, those kind of parameters that we need to keep in mind to actually fly missions like that, to help us identify mm-hmm. archaeological sites on aerial drone surveys rather than just collecting landscape kind of spatial topography data, but actually starting to collect aerial imagery and archaeological data as well. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. One thing that I would say about that is that it's contextual, right? It's only sure. going to, in my opinion, it's only going to be applicable in certain situations, definitely in the Western US, the Southwest, Intermountain West,
yeah,
the playas that you were just talking about, right?
Right.
A lot of the Colorado Plateau that I work on, we can potentially see those artifact scatters, those sites on the landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, immediately when we're talking about that, my mind runs to lithic scatters because that's what I'm trained in working with primarily. But, mm-hmm. you know, if we're talking about later Holocene period archaeology, especially if we're looking at residential structures, masonry architecture, those types of things, you know, those are really going to stand out on the landscape and some of these imagery data sets. And yeah, I think we can now start to think about how to do this a little bit more effectively. And kind of another example of a project that I'm working on built into the field school this summer, we're also using a thermal sensor to collect some data as well to try to see if that will give us some better insight about what's shallowly buried, what kind of subsurface features might be present on some of these sites. If it is going to work as well as I'm expecting it to, we'll then turn around and use that data to inform us about where to put some of our test units. So again, going back to the efficiency issue, but also doing archaeology in, I would kind of argue, more ethically in terms of the fieldwork. We don't need to go out and dig up the entire site because in the process of doing so, we're destroying that archaeological site. But if we have very specific questions, if we're looking for hearth features that we want to collect charcoal from, or for trying to key in on pit houses or kind of some kind of pit features, then at times some data like thermal data may help us in be better informed about where to look, what part of the site we should actually be putting those test units into.
Right. Not unlike using GPR to decide where on the site you're going to take. I mean, I think we're probably all in agreement about the robotization of the field. Is it's not to replace, you know, us as people trying to understand what people in the past did, but it's to use the right tool for the job. And because as the tool set expands, we can hopefully do a better job. I actually, since you mentioned sensors, what kinds of sensors have you been using on your drones for various projects? What have you had a lot of success with? What are you experimenting with or exploring for the future?
So most of the time, what I'm doing is using drones to kind of augment other aspects of my research. And so just the standard camera that comes on the DJI Phantom, you know, I always say it's basically just a fancy GoPro. That has historically been my go-to sensor. I also really enjoy using the Red Edge and the Sequoia multispectral sensors, because that's going to, you know, give us some vegetation health information that we can also look at questions about what's underneath the surface of the ground. I've been able to help out other colleagues looking at the health of plants and investigating non-archaeological questions related to pinyon juniper die-off events and things like that. And now recently I'm integrating the thermal sensor into the DJI Matrix really for the first time this summer. So we'll kind of see how that works.
Are these sensors that are mostly designed for like forestry and agriculture, or where? How do you learn about these?
Part of it just comes down to I'm personally and inherently interested in this. So I'm always looking at, you know, what kind of new sensors we could strap onto a drone that would answer archaeological questions, right? Honestly, it leads to the question, or it leads to the issue of why I got out of the aerospace industry personally, because I wanted to be able to think a little bit more critically about questions, right? I personally got tired of memorizing flow charts and checklists, and I wanted to think outside of the box a little bit. And so doing archaeology, and especially archaeology with drones, has really allowed me to do that, because you're constantly thinking about, oh, what in the world could I use vegetation health indices for? And, you know, those types of things are not what many people think of in terms of archaeology, but there's a reason that this linear strip of grass is either growing better or not as well as the grass around it, right? And at times there might be some cultural buried feature underneath the surface of the ground that's leading to that.
You know, I want to go back to the thermal sensor real quick, because well before I ever owned my first drone, and before drones were, you know, really coming into wide availability and popularity from a price standpoint, this was probably back in, I don't know if I had to guess, 2007, 2008. We were working on a big project in Nevada, and I just started thinking of alternate ways we could do this, because it was really quickly that we figured out that we were on essentially a mining district, and it was, which made sense. We were between two mining towns that were active both about the same time, about 20 miles apart. And all the area in between was just prospect pits and active mines, right? That we found, all dating to about the turn of the early 1900s, late 1800s. And almost every single site or feature had tin cans on it. Almost every single one. And if we had gone out there ahead of time and done like a 100-meter wide like recon survey with people and just determined first off, yes, we are on a mining district, because that getting the permission to call everything basically a feature or element of the district rather than recording every single, you know, prospect pit and cairn combo as a site, we ended up calling them elements of the district. But we had to get that permission from the BLM, I believe was the agency, before we did that. And once they did that, then that made our recording go a lot faster. But if we'd known that ahead of time, and then we could have flown a thermal sensor, because I'll tell you what, the middle of the day in Nevada, those cans were hot. You couldn't touch anything else. You try to pick one up to look at it, and you just have to throw it down because your fingers are burning. And a thermal sensor would have come in really handy. Now, I'm almost joking right there, but then I'm kind of not. With your work with thermal sensors, since I've never actually worked with one, is that almost too hot? Can it resolve that, like that, the difference between the can and the ground in a 100-degree day in central Nevada? Asking for a friend.
I would say have me back on in a couple of months and ask me that specific question again. But nice. After we try out a few things this summer with the projects that I have going on. But, yeah. You know, I think partly it comes down to being strategic about when we're flying and collecting that thermal data. As someone who knows exactly how hot cans get in the middle of the desert, in the middle of the summer, you know, I would say it probably doesn't matter too much about what time of the day you're flying, but, you know, doing a little testing, you know, taking a morning flight, a noon flight, and an afternoon flight, just to kind of see what that's going to look like, you know, you can really narrow that down. But I would say that specific temperature differential there, you would be able to pick up fairly well, even in the middle of the day, potentially. Yeah, depending on the thermal sensor itself. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. And that's what I really like about this whole, I hate to say it, but new technology that we're applying to archaeology, right? Because it's hardly new at this point, but new to archaeologists, but understanding I think that's the other thing we have to get past. At the beginning of this episode, we talked about how when people think of drones, they think of quadcopters. Well, the other thing they think of when they think of drones is taking fancy pictures and then maybe doing some photogrammetry, maybe just to, like, you know, I carry a small DJI Mavic Mini with me in my backpack, because if we get to a location on a survey that maybe is, you know, there might be a flat spot on the top of a really difficult climb to get up, and that could be dangerous to actually get up and over this hill to get up to the flat spot to check it out, we just fly the drone up there if we've got a good wind for it and see if there's a reason to go up there. You know what I mean? See if there's anything giving us an indication that, yeah, we should really take the chance and get up there. So having the right tool for the right job and understanding all these different sensors and the things that you can do and the different applications of them is so incredibly important. It's not just fancy pictures. So I'm glad you're bringing that in and exploring some of those new things. We've got to go kind of soon, but can you think of any sensors you haven't flown with, or anything, maybe dream sensors that don't exist yet that you'd like to have and do, besides something Star Trek like that allows you to see into the ground? Because if I ever win the lottery, I'm inventing a shovel testing drone for the Midwest and East Coast. So, you know, right. We'll cover that. But what's your dream sensor, or something in the future that maybe, or something that exists now that you maybe just don't have yet?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. For my personal use and interest, I'm pretty happy with my setup that I have with, you know, my RGB visible light sensor, the multispectral, and then the thermal. But I do know of some of my colleagues at other institutions who are really pushing things to see just what they can strap onto drones effectively and what kind of sensors that they can essentially make themselves, and are really even starting to play around with things like magnetometry on drones and things like that.
Nice. All right. Well, I think with that, this has been a fantastic episode. You're getting ready to start your field school. I would love to have you back on at some point later in the summer when you've had a chance to finish that up, digest it a little bit, and see what kind of applications you guys had. And just talk about from a preliminary standpoint, without having any papers written or anything like that, how did it go? How were your applications? How did probably teaching new people how to fly and learning, you know, some of those mechanics, and certain sensors have different probably ways that you need to fly and set up your flight plans and stuff like that. I'd be real interested to find out how all that went this summer with a new crop of students.
Yeah, I would love to come back and chat about that sometime, you know, later this year, later this fall or something, when we all kind of get back out of our field work mode and more into the to the lab, the classroom, the office. Yeah. So sounds good to me. I'd love to.
Awesome.
That's right.
We'd all love
right.
to have you.
Well, thanks a lot. Thank you, everybody, for attending. And thank you, Dr. Jesse Toon, for showing up and telling us all about drones and the fantastic classes and instruction you're giving your students. And for everybody else, check out the show notes for this episode, arcpodnet.com/archaeotech/154 for that link to the Life and Ruins episode that Dr. Toon was on. And any other links that we happen to pull out of this episode will stick right there as well. So thank you, Dr. Toon, and thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me on.
Remember to wash your hands. We're not out of it yet.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.arcpodnet.com/archaeotech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at arcpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
We're also using...
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.
With the McDonald's app, you can get your favorite thing delivered to your door. So if you were looking for a reason to skip washing those dishes you left in the sink, consider this a sign.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Right now, get $0 delivery fee with any purchase of $15 or more, only in the app. At participating McDonald's, minimum purchase excludes tax and service fees. Delivery prices may be higher than in restaurants. Other fees may apply, not valid with any other offer, discount, or coupon.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.